If Interstate 5 is the main street of the West Coast, the Pacific Crest Trail is its sidewalk, but a rugged sidewalk it can be. It's easy to take day trips on the trail, a few miles out and back, but it's also there for adventurers, people who want to spend days or weeks or even months hiking the PCT. Today's guest chose days. John Rhea lives in Ashland now, but he was a resident of Iowa when he undertook a Pacific Crest Trail adventure. It clearly did not scare him away from the West Coast permanently, but that trip certainly had its moments. Those are related in the book Rookies in the Wild, Fear and Gloaming on the Pacific Crest Trail. John Rhea is our guest in the studio. Thanks so much for joining us today.
How you doing, Jeff?
Good. You fancied yourself an outdoorsy kind of person, but what's the real truth here?
Well, I've always had an affection for the West. After I graduated from college, University of Missouri, I came across Canada Highway 1, just free and easy, just looking for adventure, and dropped down through Oregon and fell in love with Oregon. Stayed in the Ashland area for about 10 years before I moved back to the Midwest and began a career back there, a career in journalism, and started a family. So I always had an affection for the West and wanted to come back, and eventually we did.
Did you spend much time, I mean, doing the outdoorsy thing when you lived here?
A little bit, yeah. Sure, it's hard not to. You know, that's what you do here. We spent a lot of time hiking, not as seriously as the book relates and that adventure, but out in the woods quite a bit and just, you know, going to the Applegate River and swimming and enjoying the outdoors was one of our main things we did here, for sure.
The kind of things you could do if you, you know, threw some sandals and a couple towels in the car.
As we all did.
Yeah.
You know, right.
Mm-hmm. All right. So this is a bit more of a comprehensive kind of trip down the Pacific Crest Trail.
Yeah.
Now, be honest. Did you ask your son, Nick, because you thought he'd say no?
Oh, no. I didn't know what he'd say. But I asked him because I really wanted to get him out of his digitized world. He was sort of prototypical 17-year-old. He had the earbuds in all the time, and he was always playing video games. And I thought it'd be a great opportunity to get him away from that type of influence and get him out in nature and just isolate us both a little bit and hear our own bells ring and get away from civilization for a few days. It seemed like a perfect opportunity.
Hear our own bells ring?
Well, yeah. I just wanted to understand myself a little bit more, and I think you can do that when you isolate yourself in nature and get away from the typical routine. So this is obviously a great way to do that.
There are those adventure wilderness schools, I think, that they do exactly what you're talking about, where they'll go out as a group, but then for 24 hours you got to spend time alone by yourself in a stretch of the forest that nobody else enters into.
That's right.
I wasn't sure if you're aware of that, but it sounds like the kind of thing you were sort of thinking of.
Well, it could have been that, and obviously there's opportunities for meditation when you go out in the wilds, and that was part of our hope. You know, to get a little bit of that experience too, and you know, there's documented evidence of what's called the wilderness effect, and the wilderness effect is actually a change, a biochemical change that takes place in the brain after you've been in wilderness or isolated in nature for up to 72 hours. It takes that long for it to take effect. And what happens is the certain blood proteins help you think clearer. And you have better mental acuity. So, in short, being in nature can make you smarter. And that is a new a field of environmental neuroscience, as I understand it.
But it takes 72 hours.
Yeah, at least that. Uh-huh. Get rid of the heebie-jeebies and get rid of all the old stuff.
So just going off for a day or two doesn't quite get you there.
Apparently not.
So, John, what was the original plan, and how did you envision it all unfolding?
Well, the original plan, as I said, was to just get away for a few days, and I didn't really know what that meant, but I was desk-bound at my job back in Iowa and wanted to do something different and challenge myself just a little bit. I thought a backpacking experience would be great. I hadn't ever done backpacking, but I knew I could walk. So I could put one foot in front of the other. That I could do really well, and I figured, well, that's a good way to go, and backpacking sounded pretty ideal. Put us in nature, just breathe some fresh air and all that. And so we put together an itinerary centered around a portion of the Pacific Crest Trail. It took a while to figure that out because I wanted to go out west, but the West obviously is a huge place. Where to go? The Pacific Crest Trail is iconic. It really had the call of the wild about it. So we centered on a little stretch of the PCT in the Trinity Alps Wilderness. And it was described in a book by Dennis Lewin, who is a outdoor writer. And he described this stretch of trail through the Trinity Alps as one of the most spectacular on the PCT. And so we thought that would be ideal. And I had, to tell you the truth, I had a lot of trepidations about being in the wilderness. So as I looked at that trail on the map, I could see all these little lakes there. And one of the thoughts I had was, well, at least we'd always have fresh water nearby. And if there was a forest fire, we could dive into one of these lakes. That was my serious thought at the time.
Well, so the kinds of things that you think about when you've been living in Iowa for a long time, I mean, I don't want to denigrate the state. It's obviously somewhat flatter than Oregon and California.
Flat.
But what kinds of wilderness experiences, if any, are available in the state of Iowa?
Well, you know, there aren't. And we were there, and you hit the edge of Des Moines, and it's basically cornfields for as far as you can see. And it is, you know, it's beautiful in that way, in that Midwestern way. It's very sort of heartland, and the skies are wonderful. But to tell you the truth, a lot of times I'd look at the skies and I could see clouds off on the horizon. My first thought would be mountains. I was back in Oregon. Then I go, no, it's clouds.
Just clouds.
Just clouds. But, Iowa, you know, the waterways are fairly polluted. That was a consideration. The aquifers are fairly polluted, unfortunately. There's a lot of agricultural runoff and pesticides and chemicals in there. We didn't allow our kids to swim in the waterways very much. There's not that much clean water. Iowa is about 99% agricultural, and you're right not to denigrate the state. You know, it's a beautiful place. And there's places in the Midwest that are absolutely incredible, like Minnesota and Wisconsin have beautiful, clear lakes, obviously. But that all was a motivator to get out west for me.
And you did indeed. The book is called Rookies in the Wild, Fear and Gloaming on the Pacific Crest Trail. Back with John Rhea and your comments and questions as we go on to the Jefferson Exchange. We'll return in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is John Rhea. He lives in Ashland now. He lived in Iowa when he planned a trip on the Pacific Crest Trail with his then-teenaged son. The book about this is called Rookies in the Wild, Fear and Gloaming on the Pacific Crest Trail. It's about what happens when people who really think roughing it might be looking for the ice machine in the motel, and they go into something that's a bit more comprehensive than that. You might have stories as well to share about your own experiences on the Pacific Crest Trail or some questions to ask of John and his experience. Please join us at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You had mentioned that the segment you chose was something that started in Trinity Alps, but there was an earlier plan, wasn't there, for a Crater Lake leg?
Oh, that's right. I thought it would be really nice to hike from about Ashland up to Crater Lake, and that was the original plan. But I had some good friends here, and at the time I was in Iowa, so it was still all in the planning stage. And I talked to my friends here in Oregon, and they said, don't do that, because that trail is just dreadful for mosquitoes at that time of year, late August, through the summer, basically. And the so Sky Lakes region, all that's supposed to be very filled with mosquitoes, and that just sounded terrible. So they suggested going to a higher elevation above 5,000 feet and the Trinity Alps Wilderness. And portions of the trail down there in Northern California offered that. So that sounded really good. You know, mosquito avoidance was popped up high on the list.
Right. You have a fair amount of those in Iowa, I gather.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this state bird.
Which has been said of many of the upper Midwestern states, sure. If you're not a regular hiker, is the Pacific Crest Trail, when you first look at its immensity and the many features it traverses, is it beyond imagining?
Well, it is in terms of its total length. And if you're a through hiker, I mean, that's an entirely different consideration. And there's plenty of those these days, and I think even more than ever, are encouraged to try the Pacific Crest Trail. It's gotten some notoriety, obviously, with the publication of the book Wild, et cetera. And, but the trail itself was not really that intimidating. It was more compelling because it was so iconic. And it just sounded romantic in a way, too. So the Trinity Alps Wilderness sounded completely romantic. So that sounded like us somehow. If we're going to do something, we want to do it grand and have a great time have a really unusual, fantastic experience that met our expectations for adventure.
I imagine the responses when you told people in Iowa would have ranged anywhere from, oh, that sounds wonderful, to, are you nuts? I mean, where did most of those fall?
Well, most of people didn't, that I talked to back then in Iowa, really didn't know anything about backpacking like I did and weren't that familiar with the Pacific Crest Trail. But of course, as we studied around and looked at trails, we got more familiar with it. And really, you know, the preparation for going out backpacking is a great big part of the deal. Obviously, And the book itself talks a lot about the preparation. There's a saying that Abraham Lincoln said if he's going to cut down a tree, it would take 4 hours, and 3 hours would be spent sharpening the saw. So there's quite a bit of that in the book. And for a novice, that's really important, too, because you have to get geared up. You have to buy all the equipment. You have to buy the backpacks and the stuff you never even thought of, like the bear spray and the moisture-wicking underwear and sporks. I didn't know what a spork was. Now I do. And the sleeping pads, and you know, you're going to get a down sleeping bag, but is it going to be good to 30 degrees, or should you get the 20 degree bag and spend another $100? All those considerations, and that was quite part of the adventure, really.
Shopping for shoes alone sounds like a car shopping trip, you know, looking for the features, you know.
Well, boots are, you know, they're the essential piece of equipment. You have to have great boots. And I spent a lot of time researching those to the point where I was basically dreaming about them at night. And I did finally find what I thought were the ideal pair of boots in some Vasques. And I bought those for myself and my son in Des Moines. And that sort of sealed the deal when I found those boots on the shelf and they were exactly what I was looking for. I was just like, okay, it's all going to happen. You know, it's all meant to be. Here's the boots that I was looking for. We're going.
Other than the boots, and I mean, before you actually started your shopping expeditions, I mean, did you and Nick have any gear worthy of a day's long hike?
No, nothing. No, okay. We started from scratch. We were total rookies. We didn't know anything. I had to research every bit of what we were going to take and what we were going to do. And that really turned out to be, a part of the adventure was the fear that I started to generate, because as I started to do the research on the subject, I got a subscription to Backpacker Magazine, which is a fantastic magazine. It really is. It's great. They do such a good job with service journalism. And I started to read it, and it just really scared the heck out of me, because every article was like, you know, how to survive when you run out of water, how to survive if you get bit by a rattlesnake, how to splint a broken leg. And I started to think, look, I'm actually going to do this. I'm going to take us out into an area where all these things are possible. And it sounded like maybe even probable that some catastrophe was going to happen, and I was going to be responsible for our survival. And all those fears just started to manifest during the preparation period, especially my, it all came down to being a parent too, because here I was going to take my son into these areas supposedly that had so many unique ways to kill us. And what was I doing? I was violating my prime directive as a parent, which is not to place your kid in harm's way. And here I was going to do exactly that. So that just exacerbated everything in the preparation period.
And Nick was about to be a senior in high school.
He was going to be a senior in high school. Yeah, it was a great time to be with him. I had an older son who was off on his own already, had graduated college, and he was doing great. And Nick was sort of the last bit before we became empty nesters. So I really wanted to take advantage of that and hang out with him a little bit and have this father-son bonding experience. You know, hopefully we would live through it.
John Rea is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Rookies in the Wild, Fear and Gloaming on the Pacific Crest Trail. We've asked for other people's experiences, and we got an email from Bruce in Ashland talking about danger. And he writes, I had an exciting time, hiked the PCT about 8 years ago. On October 13th, I ran into a large group of Mexican mafia marijuana growers above the Applegate. A very large Hispanic man with perfect English, dressed in camo, approached me with his clip on his belt. No sign of his firearm, which I knew he had. I had wandered off just a little from the PCT, and there was a trailer for the generator running with an antenna sticking up right in the saddle of the mountain. I was trying to avoid it, and I heard Spanish-speaking people down in the valley below me talking as they worked. He was very polite, and my dog and I continued on, but what happened afterwards was scary. A truck came down along the trail with four-wheelers in the back. When they got out of the truck, they started firing high-powered rifle shots. The shots were fired at me, but I knew they were to scare me away. My heart was racing, and I didn't feel safe until I got about 5 miles away from these people. This occurred right along the PCT, just into California, when the trail doubles back toward the Applegate. One of many experiences I've had hiking the PCT. So that from Bruce in Ashland. So you were more afraid of furrier creatures than these, I gather.
Yeah, the one fear that really got locked into my brain was fear of cougars. And that, when you think about it, that's a reasonable fear, really. There's not too many critters out here in the planet that will hunt you down and kill you and eat the heart out of your chest cavity. In fact, there's very few. And when you maybe an anaconda could take you down, or a crocodile, and certainly a shark, and lions. That's about it. So here we are about to hike in a area, part of the world that was renowned for cougars. And for some reason, I really couldn't get that fear out of my head. I just kept imagining that they were there, and that we made perfect targets, a nice week's worth of protein, easy to take down. But I studied cougars, and I studied fears, really, and realized that cougar attacks are extremely rare. There's only been 21 documented attacks or deaths from a cougar attack.
In the whole country.
In the whole country, in North America, since the 1890s. And your chances of being crushed to death by a vending machine are vastly greater. So that gave me heart, and I learned that, cougars are shy creatures, and some people who have been in the woods for a living have never even seen one, and they're easily scared off. So great. I finally put that cougar phobia behind me, and the story is that was really a struggle for me, and one day I woke up, and I just really was determined, like, that fear is gone. I'm done with that. I'm not going to go there anymore. I'm a better, saner man. I might have other things that were other bogeys in the hamper, but I really was done with cougars. And that same day, I went downstairs and I turned on the TV to a news story about a man who had been viciously attacked by a cougar in Northern California, exactly where we're going to be hiking.
Right. So let's invite listeners back into this discussion. John Rhea took a hike on the Pacific Crest Trail with his son Nick several years ago. He writes it up in the book, Rookies in the Wild, Fear and Gloaming on the Pacific Crest Trail, a real tenderfoot off in the woods where harder people are called for. Your experiences are welcome here on the Jefferson Exchange. Tell us about stuff you have seen and heard and experienced along the Pacific Crest Trail, or perhaps on some other trail as well. 800-838-3760 around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. So the cougar attack was actually in Humboldt County, wasn't it?
That's right, at Prairie Creek State Park. And that happened a number of years ago. It was sort of infamous in a way. It got a lot of news play, particularly because the couple that were hiking and the man who was attacked was saved by his wife, who was just a little pip of a thing in a way. She was like 5'2" and barely over 100 pounds. But she managed to find an enormous branch and slug this cougar until it finally got off her husband. But it took a while, and the cougar was serious. He took down this guy and really wanted to eat him.
Jaws clamped on his face.
Jaws clamped on his face. Yeah, I interviewed the folks, Jim and Nell Hamm in Northern California, and they gave me a very minute description of the attack. And that was one thing that he did mention. As this cougar is on top of him and had his head in its jaws, he's just became sort of stepped outside his body and was thinking, like, this is so remarkable. I'm eye to eye with this creature that's trying to eat me. And I just thought that was kind of an interesting sort of a comment to make at that time.
Well, his description too, Jim Hamm, about the feeling his teeth against the cougar's teeth.
Right, grinding teeth to teeth.
That'll set your teeth on edge.
Right.
There's an interesting sidelight that you give here, though. Mountain lions are beginning to appear in the Midwest as well.
As I understand, yeah. And, they used to be all over the Western Hemisphere. In fact, for land mammals, they had the biggest range of any land mammal in the world for, millennia, actually, until we started to eliminate them. And they could be found just anywhere in North America, any state. But we successfully eliminated them, and I successfully, ironically. And now they're only available in pockets in the West and certain places in Florida. However, they have started to make inroads back to the Midwest. And in 2005, I believe in Iowa, there was over 500 cougar sightings reported in every county in the state, which I think is quite unusual. And before that, the last cougar sighting before that in the state had been in the late 1800s. So they are probably migrating. I don't know for sure, but they're migrating across the top of the continental United States and coming down through the Midwest states, through Minnesota. And it makes sense in a way, as they grow and their territories shrink out here, they have to move somewhere, and they're finding the best available spaces. So they're being encouraged, I think, to intrude more and more into like suburban areas even. There's a big cougar shot in Chicago in a suburban area in 2008, and documented attacks, of course, around Boulder and other places where the cougars become habitualized. That means they kind of get used to being close to civilization, and they become emboldened, and they'll come in and take a dog or a goat or chickens or something like that.
You give a couple of good history lessons in the book Rookies in the Wild, one of which is a history lesson on what we've done to the cougars, which is we were rather thorough in our attempts to exterminate them.
That's right. Throughout the 20th century, cougars were being eliminated rapidly and with very specific direction. There was a lot of cattlemen associations that hired professional hunters, and in fact, the USDA had an arm that was devoted to cougar hunting, and they had hired some 300 or 400 hunters that went out and eliminated cougars because they were thought to be a threat to livestock, and somewhat rightfully to people and obviously kids and all that too. So they were virtually eliminated at that point, and there was a lot of glory associated with the idea of hunting cougars at that time, probably because it got to the idea of the final taming of the West and the one last wild vestige that was out there in the early 20th century were cougars. So hunting cougars got some people quite a bit of fame and rated stories in the New York Times, and Zane Grey would write about these famous cougar hunters, and all that sort of, I think, heated up the anti-cougar feeling at the time.
John Rea's book, again, is Rookies in the Wild, Fear and Gloaming on the Pacific Crest Trail. And, John, one of the other good history lessons you've given here is about the PCT itself. And I sense you gained a new appreciation for Teddy Roosevelt through the process of preparing this book.
I did. And Teddy Roosevelt, oh, my gosh. You know, he was fantastic in a lot of ways. I mean, you had to admire the guy. He got chiseled into, you know, Mount Rushmore for a reason, I think. But, you know, he led the charge up San Juan Hill and all that. But he was a vigorous defender of the environment, and he loved the West in particular. During his tenure as vice president and then later as president, he managed to set aside some 230 million acres as national forests and some national parks. And I think his reasoning there was two-edged. First of all, he had a deep appreciation for that kind of country as being emblematic of the United States, and it was one of the things that made the United States outstanding in the world and gave it stature, was its magnificent natural wonders, like the Grand Canyon. And so he wanted to preserve that in perpetuity as best he could. And then the other reason was it was selfish, I think. He was a big game hunter, and he liked the idea. He liked nothing more on vacation than to go out west and hunt big game, cougars especially. So for Roosevelt, it was preserving his vacation spots for himself, where he could really enjoy that. And he didn't cotton to any miners and ranchers out there that complained about preserving land. He really stood tall against those kinds of protests at the time.
Interesting. So conservation for him was a manly thing. It was
was
a manly man.
And it exists today too in a good way. I mean, there's a balance there, I think, between hunting interests and preserving land where animals can breed and grow.
So who was the original champion of the Pacific Crest Trail?
Well, his name was Clinton C. Clark, and he was an oil man in California. He was president of the LA Outdoor Association or something like that, and he wasn't much of an outdoorsman himself, but he appreciated it a lot. And as he got into the twilight of his career and he had made all his money, he had an altruistic streak, and he wanted to give back, and he thought a hiking trail would be really fantastic, linking, you know, the Mexican border to the Canadian border. So he started to put that together, and of course, it's a mammoth task. There's a lot of land right away and all kinds of land acquisition that has to go on, plus the construction of the trail itself. So that took years and years and a lot of money. And it was helped by two fortuitous events. One was the Great Depression. So the Great Depression brought along the Civilian Conservation Corps, which were there to work using taxpayer money. And what better way to put them to work than to build this trail? So part of the PCT was built through the CCC initiative during the Great Depression. And then Clark himself was sort of he was a marketer, and he knew how to reach people. So he organized, in the 30s, he organized teams of Boy Scouts to go out, and they would map the trail and establish the trail route. And these exploits of these Boy Scouts were followed with great relish by readers of newspapers in the 30s. And they were publicized, and it took almost 2 years for that Boy Scout initiative to complete itself.
More of the PCT history and more of John Rhea's history on it with his son Nick in the book Rookies in the Wild when we return to the Jefferson Exchange. We'll take your phone calls and emails as well. Back here with John and you in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is John Rhea. He lives in Ashland now, but he was living in Iowa years ago when he decided, you know, this is a good time for a bonding trip with my son before he enters his senior year of high school. So John and Nick hit the Pacific Crest Trail, ended up with a bunch of experiences worth writing down. So John did. He wrote a book called Rookies in the Wild, Fear and Gloaming on the Pacific Crest Trail, about his experiences, which obviously he survived, but there were a few fears beforehand, as some people may have about hiking that or any other trail. Join us with your experiences. Join us with questions or comments for John at 800-838-3760 around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about one of the history lessons you offer in the book, one of which is a good history of the Pacific Crest Trail itself and its original champion, Clinton C. Clark. I guess the part that really brought me up short, though, was to find out when the ceremony was held for the completion of the trail.
Yeah, that's right. They drove the spike for the completion of the trail, I believe, in 1968. And by then, Clinton C. Clark had died, and he had actually passed the baton to another fellow, Warren Rogers, who carried on the business of completing the trail and doing all the land acquisitions, et cetera, and getting the right-of-ways. And Warren Rogers had, drunk the same PCT Kool-Aid that Clinton Clark had, so he was as devoted as Clark. But he died also a year before the trail was completed. So I think that's a definition of irony.
Mm-hmm. I guess so. They never got to actually walk the trail themselves, at least not in its completed version.
It did not.
So, but the land acquisition part, I never even thought about this part of it. But, I mean, probably so many different owners they had to get rights of way from.
Yeah, they did. I'm sure there's tons of private land that the trail had to go through, and people needed convincing. And, of course, all the money for that needed to be raised along the way, too, because any of those efforts, reaching out to people and identifying the land, took a lot of money. I'm not quite sure exactly how much, but it was obviously a four-decade project to complete that.
All right, so somebody had done that work by the time that you and Nick hit the trail, but before you even got to hit the trail, I mean, you talked about the process of purchasing the equipment and which sleeping bag you need, which tent you need, which pad, the boots, all that stuff. Well, your wife, Deb, asked the obvious question, how are you going to get all the stuff on the plane?
That's true. I had all this stuff, and I was staging it in the living room, and it was just these two mounds of things, including the backpacks, that were stuck up like twin mountains there, and all the other stuff was like the scree around these backpack mountains, and all the food and the little cooking gear and the little headlight you wear on your head and all this stuff. And she goes, "Well, how are you going to get it out there?" And I thought, I don't know, you know. And the first thought was, "Oh, we could put it in the backpacks and ship it out there." But that just seemed a little too tempting, perhaps, for some bored baggage handler to see these nice backpacks going through. I don't know. So she suggested these two duffel bags that we had. And the story about the duffel bags is that we had bought them for our older son so he could transport his dirty laundry to back and forth to college. So we had this set of duffels. We actually own the largest set of luggage in West Des Moines, and I'm totally – that's a true
actually,
fact.
The luggage has its own house, or did.
It did, yeah. I built this little house, a playhouse for my kids out in the backyard. They never played in it, and it became the storage for our luggage because – for some reason, my wife was obsessed with buying luggage. At every trip we took had its own tote or valise or suitcase, and as a result, we had this enormous pile of luggage, including these two duffel bags. Anyway, I grabbed the duffel bags out of the little house in the backyard, pulled them inside, stuffed everything in. Beautiful, you know, completely camouflaged, as you know, as anonymous as an old tire, and that was the way we got all the stuff out.
So I haven't heard, you know, Nick doesn't really show up as a narrative voice in the book. Granted, it's your book, you wrote it. But, I mean, how much was he helping with this whole process of getting ready? How much was he anticipating being out there with this old man on the trail and having to give up his earbuds for a while?
Well, unfortunately, I think he thought I knew what I was doing.
Whoops.
Which would have been a surprise for him if he actually knew the truth, that I didn't. And I was winging it at every stage. And, yeah, we went shopping together and we looked for gear and all that. But basically, I was planning the trip, and he was quite fine with whatever I came up with. He figured it was sort of my deal and my trips, and he was along for the ride. So he doesn't really show up in the narrative that much, but he's sort of a quiet person anyway. His older son is very gregarious and loquacious, and
older brother
is loquacious and talkative, and he's, like many siblings, are the opposite. He was very sort of reserved and introspective. So being on the trail with him was interesting. We didn't have a lot of conversations, but the conversations we did have, I thought, were really meaningful. We talked a bit about God at one point and got his point of view about spirituality. But for the most part, we were quite quiet. And I think that was really great for him. It was just so perfect to be able to hike along the trail for hours on end, really, and just have this beautiful, magnificent landscape slip by and see these incredible sights, these cliffs and the enormous trees and all that. And in a way, it was the scene and nature that was doing the talking to us. And that was enough conversation for most of the trail.
Then I hope the discussion of God came out of a calm and tranquil moment and not a moment of fear because you heard something growling in the bushes.
Well, I had my moments of prayer, that's for sure, because, and I'm not a religious guy, but there were moments when I thought, oh my God, please help me and get me out of this. I don't know what I'm doing. And there was one point, I think, where the trail sort of disappeared, and I was trying like crazy to read the maps.
Is this the Mavis Lake incident?
This is actually a little bit later than the Mavis Lake incident. Although that was another point of being lost, of which we had several, I must say, Jeff. But at this one stage, we were hiking along, and I thought I had it figured out. I actually thought I had projected when we would be walking along this part of the trail, our shadows would be preceding us at a slight angle, and we were walking along that portion of the trail, and of course, the shadows were trailing behind. And it's just like, oh, what is happening here? You know, I'm totally mixed up. And then the trail doubled back, and then it seemed to disappear. So I was quite confused. I thought, we're off on a spur trail somehow, and we're about to wander off into the middle of the wilderness, and they'll never find us. So I was praying at the point. I said, dear God, please just don't let me screw this up. And right about that moment, a fellow pops up on the trail, and he just in a very spirited voice says, well, you're the first folks I've seen on the Pacific Crest Trail all day. So there we had affirmation. And the nice thing about that was I was thinking, like, if we ever encounter somebody in that moment, I'm going to have to ask them, where are we? Because I didn't know. And I'd have to go through that embarrassment and, you know, and some skepticism from my son, I'm sure, let alone the person that I was going to encounter. What were we doing out there if we didn't know where we were? And I didn't have to say a word. No, this fellow comes out. You're on the PCT. Great. We were safe.
Was it hard at times then, obviously, to find the PCT? I mean, the maps differ, or are they just not as detailed as they could be, or the markings on the trail not
you know, the trail, by and large, is really, really fine and well-marked and well-defined. And obviously, there's people that walk the whole length, you know, 2,600 miles without anything close to my befuddlement. But there are times when the trail does take an odd turn. There was a couple intersections that we found where the trail sign was just lying in the dirt. And it's just like, okay, well, which way do we go now? Did it mean that way? Did it mean that way? And in the wilderness areas, some of that paucity of signage is deliberate, because the Forest Service wants to preserve the wilderness experience as much as possible. So where the trail does go through wilderness areas, there are very few signs And that's to preserve the true feeling of the wilderness.
Do you believe much in omens, John Rhea? I mean, were there moments in the preparation prior to or in the commission of the walk along the Pacific Crest Trail depicted in Rookies in the Wild when you thought, okay, that's an omen that says we shouldn't do this, or that's an omen that says we should do this?
Well, when I did encounter some omens, and at those moments I was too committed to turn back, let's just say. So obviously the story about the cougar attack in California, when I saw that on the TV, that was an omen, and I was thinking, oh, well, here we go. You know, I fear cougars, and here they are. They're everywhere. So, you know, we're not going, but obviously I got over that, and we plunged ahead. And then there was one specific that was I just thought was cute and interesting. We were at the trailhead. We were just starting out. We were all full of excitement. We were ready to go. It felt like Neil Armstrong about to take that last step onto the moon. We were all geared up. And I was still full of apprehension, but I was very excited and thrilled. And we hear this click, 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 and up on the trail, these are trekking poles, and up pops this little old man. And he's all dressed head to toe in this brown rain suit. And he strolls past us, and he plops himself down and says, I'm hungry. And his name was Smith Edwards, and he was indeed about 75 years old, and he was through hiking solo. And I just thought at that moment, at that particular moment, just when we were about to take off on the trail, the fact that he arrived, and it was like, well, if Smith Edwards can do it at 75, we can certainly manage a few miles on the trail. So that was a very, very good sign.
Well, I think I asked the total distance and time you were trying to accumulate on the trail.
Well, we were planned to go for about 6 days is what we did. So it was like 3 days in and 3 days out, you know, around in there.
Mm-hmm. And how regimented a schedule was this? I mean, obviously, you had a plane ticket back to Iowa that you had to be there to use. But I mean, other than that, was there?
Well, I studied the maps, you know, ad nauseum, and I had decided that there was these points that we were going to make, these lakes that we were going to camp by. And I was really determined, and once I got that in my head, I was not going to be deterred. We were going to these lakes, and the prime reason, as I said before, was we'd have access to water, which is great, but also if there was a forest fire, we could get into these lakes. And to tell you the truth, that was a serious consideration. There were some fires around that were reported, none closer than 150 miles to where we were hiking, but they were around, so the idea was fresh. And the thing about the lakes, though, is they're in these cirques. And so after a long day of hiking, then to get down to the lake, you have to climb down these cirques. And cirques are three-sided bowls that were carved by the glacier advance and retreat about 20,000 years ago. And the fourth side of the bowl is where the glacier finally retreated and carved out millions of tons of rock. And in the center of these cirques are often these little pristine lakes because the springs have been exposed or there's snow melt there. So, but to get down into them, they're very steep. So at the end of the day, we had this long climb trek into these cirques. And then the next day, a very, very strenuous climb out because they're extremely steep. This is not the PCT trail. These are these side trails that we had to go on. So even though I was determined to hit these particular points along the way, they proved out to be problematic getting in and out.
I guess you had topographical maps, didn't you?
We did, yeah, topographical maps. I didn't really know how to read them that well, you know. You could see a lot of squiggly lines going down the cirque, and you thought, well, that's going to be steep, and it's like, but you have no idea until you actually do it.
Is it a little harder to conceive after 25 years in Iowa?
Anything's harder to conceive after 25 years in Iowa, but the scale is so different out here, really, than, of course, in the Midwest or anywhere else in the country, really. Scale's tremendous.
It's just bigger.
It's huge.
Bigger. Given the fear of cougars, and thanks again for the extensive research into cougars in the book, what was the most interesting critter you ran across?
Well,
did any particularly give you any trouble, concern?
No, there was no trouble along the way at all. The only malady that befell us was Nick stuck a knife into his thumb at one point shortly after I told him to be careful. The knife was sharp. And then I had a strain on my knee, iliotibial syndrome, which happens to a lot of hikers that aren't in the greatest of shape. And it's a strain that affects your knee. And curiously, it only gets you when you're climbing or walking down. But if you walk up, you don't get it. So what happened? That was on the last day of the trail, and then the next day we faced this long 8 mile, you know, downward leg. So it was completely in pain. But those were the only two things we encountered. As far as critters, no, I was really hoping to see a bear, or at least didn't come close to that. We saw some great butterflies and bugs about and chipmunks and things like that.
But you were outfitted with bear spray that was
we had
like
bear
a fire
spray. Oh, yeah. This stuff would, you know, stop a bear, stone them out at 40 feet. It was, you know, it was the preferred bear spray of the Alaskan State Patrol. And we figured if it's good enough for them, you know, it might come in handy for us as well. So we were prepped for that.
So reaching, coming back to the trailhead and getting to the rental car and everything, I mean, was it a case of kiss the ground, I'm glad I'm home alive? Or, I wish this could go on.
It was both, actually, but it was definitely that. I mean, I really wanted to get through this safely. That was my hope and prayer the whole time. I just wanted to get through it and not have my kid screwed up or fall off a cliff or do anything damaging to him. And, we made it. So I was tremendously relieved. But the curious thing is that once we did get in the car finally and we got all our stuff off and switched out of our boots to our tennies and started driving down, it wasn't 10 minutes on the drive off the trail that I wanted to be back on it. And right there and then Nick and I made a pact to go back, and we've actually been back to that same stretch of trail along the Trinity Alps Wilderness now 4 times.
Excellent. Okay. Yeah. So there are more books potentially down the road.
I don't know about that one, but I've taken a fly fishing, so maybe it's Rookies in the Water. I don't know.
Okay. That'll be a good sequel to Rookies in the Wild, Fear and Gloaming on the Pacific Crest Trail. John Rhea wrote it, lives in Ashland now. John, good job on both. Thanks for being here.
All right. Thank you, Jeff.
And that'll do it for today's exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects and suggest guests at jeffexchange.org. Also find us on Facebook or Twitter. Tomorrow on The Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about the anniversary of the Supreme Court decision that led to legalization of contraception across the country. At 8:30, we'll talk to folks involved in a dog rescue reaching across the Pacific Ocean. And then at 9 o'clock, we will talk to the Tony Award-winning now author of, playwright of All the Way, which won a Tony Award on Broadway, the play about LBJ, which originated at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. That's all tomorrow on The Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening and have a great day.